Chapter 7 Heat is everywhere now. I can't ignore it anymore. The air is like a furnace blast so hot that my eyes and the goggles feel cool compared to the rest of my face. My hands are cool, but the gloves have big black spots from perspiration on the back, surrounded by white streaks of dried salt. On the road ahead, a crow tugs on some carrion and flies up slowly as we approach. It looks like a lizard on the road, dry and stuck to the tar. On the horizon appears an image of buildings, shimmering slightly. I look down at the map and figure it must be Bowman. I think about ice water and air conditioning. On the street and sidewalks of Bowman, we see almost no one, even though plenty of parked cars show they're here. All inside. We swing the machines into an angled parking place with a tight turn that points them outward for when we're ready to go. A lone, elderly person wearing a broad-brimmed hat watches us put the cycles on their stands and remove helmets and goggles. "Hot enough for you?" he asks. His expression is blank. John shakes his head and says, "God!" The expression, shaded by the hat, becomes almost a smile. "What is the temperature?" John asks. 102, he says. "Last I saw. Should go to 104. He asks how far we have come, and we tell him, and he nods with a kind of approval. "That's a long way," he says. Then he asks about the machines. The beer and air conditioning are calling, but we don't break away. We just stand there in the 102 sun, talking to this person. He is a stockman, retired, says this is pretty much ranch country around here, and he used to own a Henderson cycle years ago. It pleases me that he should want to talk about his Henderson in this 102 sun. We talk about it for a while, with growing impatience from John and Sylvia and Chris, and when we finally say goodbye, he says he is glad to have met us, and his expression is still blank, but we sense that he really meant it. He walks away with a kind of slow dignity in the 102 sun. In the restaurant, I try to comment on this, but no one is interested. John and Sylvia look really out of it. They just sit and soak up the air-conditioned air without a move. The waitress comes for the order, and that snaps them out of it a little. But they are not ready, and so she goes away again.
"I don't think I want to leave here," Sylvia says.
An image of the elderly man outside in the wide-brimmed hat comes back to me. "Think what it was like around here before air conditioning," I say. "I am," she says. "With the roads this hot and that bad back tire of mine, we shouldn't go more than 60," I say. No comment from them. Chris, in contrast to them, seems to be back to his normal self, alert and watching everything. When the food comes, he wolfs it down and then, before we are half finished, asks for more. He gets it, and we wait for him to finish. Miles later, and the heat is just ferocious. Sunglasses and goggles are not enough for this glare. You need a welder's mask. The high plains break up into washed-out and gullied hills. It is all bright, whitish tan. Not a blade of grass anywhere. Just scattered weed stalks and rocks and sand. The black of the highway is a relief to look at, so I stare down at it and study how the blur whizzes by underfoot. Beside it, I see the left exhaust pipe has picked up a bluer color than it has ever had before. I spit on my glove tips, touch it, and can see the sizzle. Not good. It's important now to just live with this and not fight it mentally. Mind control. I should talk now about Phaedrus's knife. It'll help understand some of the things we talked about. The application of this knife, the division of the world into parts, and the building of this structure is something everybody does. All the time we are aware of millions of things around us. These changing shapes, these burning hills, the sound of the engine, the feel of the throttle, each rock and weed and fence post and piece of debris beside the road. Aware of these things, but not really conscious of them, unless there is something unusual, or unless they reflect something we are predisposed to see. We could not possibly be conscious of these things and remember all of them because our mind would be so full of useless details, we would be unable to think. From all this awareness, we must select. And what we select and call consciousness is never the same as the awareness because the process of selection mutates it. We take a handful of sand from the endless landscape of awareness around us and call that handful of sand the world. Once we have the handful of sand, the world of which we are conscious, a process of discrimination goes to work on it. This is the knife. We divide the sand into parts, this and that, here and there, black and white, now and then. The discrimination is the division of the conscious universe into parts. The handful of sand looks uniform at first, but the longer we look at it, the more diverse we find it to be. Each grain of sand is different. No two are alike. Some are similar in one way, some are similar in another way, and we can form the sand into separate piles on the basis of this similarity and dissimilarity. Shades of color in different piles, sizes in different piles, grain shapes in different piles, subtypes of grain shapes in different piles, grades of opacity in different piles, and so on and on and on. You'd think the process of subdivision and classification would come to an end somewhere, but it doesn't. It just goes on and on. Classical understanding is concerned with the piles and the basis for sorting and interrelating them. Romantic understanding is directed toward the handful of sand before the sorting begins. Both are valid ways of looking at the world, although irreconcilable with each other. What has become an urgent necessity is a way of looking at the world that does violence to neither of these two kinds of understanding and unites them into one. Such an understanding will not reject sand sorting or contemplation of unsorted sand for its own sake. Such an understanding will instead seek to direct attention to the endless landscape from which the sand is taken. That is what Phaedrus, the poor surgeon, was trying to do. To understand what he was trying to do, it's necessary to see that part of the landscape, inseparable from it, which must be understood, is a figure in the middle of it, sorting sand into piles. To see the landscape without seeing this figure is not to see the landscape at all. To reject that part of the Buddha that attends to the analysis of motorcycles is to miss the Buddha entirely. There is a perennial classical question that asks, which part of the motorcycle, which grain of sand in which pile, is the Buddha? Obviously, to ask that question is to look in the wrong direction, for the Buddha is everywhere. But just as obviously to ask that question is to look in the right direction, for the Buddha is everywhere. About the Buddha that exists independently of any analytic thought, much has been said. Some would say too much, and would question any attempt to add to it. But about the Buddha that exists within analytic thought and gives that analytic thought its direction, virtually nothing has been said. And there are historic reasons for this. But history keeps happening, and it seems no harm and maybe some positive good to add to our historical heritage with some talk in this area of discourse. When analytic thought, the knife, is applied to experience, something is always killed in the process. That is fairly well understood, at least in the arts. Mark Twain's experience comes to mind, in which, after he had mastered the analytic knowledge needed to pilot the Mississippi River, he discovered the river had lost its beauty. Something is always killed. But what is less noticed in the arts, something is always created, too. And instead of just dwelling on what is killed, it's important also to see what's created and to see the process as a kind of death-birth continuity that is neither good nor bad, but just is. We pass through a town called Marmouth, but John doesn't stop even for a rest, and so we go on. More furnace heat, into some bad lands, and we cross the border into Montana. A sign by the road announces it. Sylvia waves her arms up and down, and I beep the horn in response, but when I look at the sign, my feelings are not jubilant at all. For me, its information causes a sudden inward tension that can't exist for them. They've no way of knowing we're now in the country where he lived. All this talk so far about classic and romantic understanding must seem a strangely oblique way of describing him. But to get at Phaedrus, this oblique route is the only one to take. To describe his physical appearance, or the statistics of his life, would be to dwell on misleading superficialities. And to come at him directly would be to invite disaster. He was insane. And when you look directly at an insane man, all you see is a reflection of your own knowledge that he's insane, which is not to see him at all. To see him, you must see what he saw, and when you are trying to see the vision of an insane man, an oblique route is the only way to come at it. Otherwise, your own opinions block the way. There is only one access to him that I can see as passable, and we still have a way to go. I've been going into all this business of analyses and definitions and hierarchies, not for their own sake, but to lay the groundwork for an understanding of the direction in which Phaedrus went. I told Chris the other night that Phaedrus spent his entire life pursuing a ghost. That was true. The ghost he pursued was the ghost that underlies all of technology, all of modern science, all of Western thought. It was the ghost of rationality itself. I told Chris that he found the ghost, and that when he found it, he thrashed it good. I think in a figurative sense, that is true. The things I hope to bring to light as we go along are some of the things he uncovered. Now the times are such that others may at last find them of value. No one then would see the ghost that Phaedrus pursued, but I think now that more and more people see it, or get glimpses of it in bad moments, a ghost which calls itself rationality, but whose appearance is that of incoherence and meaninglessness, which causes the most normal of everyday acts to seem slightly mad because of their irrelevance to anything else. This is the ghost of normal everyday assumptions, which declares that the ultimate purpose of life, which is to keep alive, is impossible, but that this is the ultimate purpose of life anyway, so that great minds struggle to cure diseases so that people may live longer, but only madmen ask why. One lives longer in order that he may live longer. There is no other purpose. That is what the ghost says. At Baker, where we stop, the thermometers are reading 108 degrees in the shade. When I take my gloves off, the metal of the gas tank is so hot I can't touch it. The engine is making ominous knick-knicking sounds from overheating. Very bad. The rear tire has worn badly, too, and I feel with my hand that it's almost as hot as the gas tank. "We're going to have to slow down," I say. "What?" "I don't think we should go over 50," I say. John looks at Sylvia, and she looks at him. Something has already been said between them about my slowness. They both look as if they've about had it. "We just want to get there fast," John says, and they both walk toward a restaurant. The chain has been running hot and dry, too. In the right-hand saddlebag, I rummage for a can of spray lubricant, find it, then start the engine and spray the moving chain. The chain is still so hot the solvent evaporates almost instantly. Then I squirt a little oil on, let it run for a minute, and shut the engine off. Chris waits patiently, then follows me into the restaurant. "I thought you said the big slump was going to come on the second day," Sylvia says as we approach the booth they are in. "Second or third," I reply. "Or fourth or fifth?" "Maybe." She and John look at each other again with the same expression they showed before. It seems to say three's a crowd. They want to go ahead fast and wait for me in some town up ahead. I'd suggest it myself, except that if they go much faster, they won't be waiting for me in some town. It'll be the side of the road.
I don't know how the people here stand this, Sylvia says.
Well, it's hard country, I say, with a little irritation. They know it's hard before they come here, and are ready for it. I add, if one person complains, he just makes it that much harder for the others. They've got stamina. They know how to keep on going. John and Sylvia don't say much, and John finishes his Coke early and is off to a bar for a snort. I go out and check the cycle luggage again and find that the new pack has been compressing a little, and so take up the slack in the ropes and retie them. Chris points to a thermometer in direct sunlight, and we see it has gone all the way above the scale at 120 degrees. Before we are out of town, I am sweating again. The cool drying-off period doesn't last even half a minute. The heat just slams into us. Even with dark sunglasses, I have to squint my eyes into slits. There's nothing but burning sand and pale sky so bright it's hard to look anywhere. It's just become white hot everywhere, a real inferno. John up ahead is speeding faster and faster. I give up on him and slow it down to 55. Unless you're just looking for trouble in this heat, you don't run tires at 85. A blowout on this stretch would really be it. I suppose they took what I said as a kind of rebuke, but I didn't have that in mind. I'm no more comfortable than they are in this heat, but there's no point in dwelling on it. All day, while I've been thinking and talking about Phaedrus, they must have been thinking about how bad all this is. That's what's really wearing them down. The thought. Some things can be said about Phaedrus as an individual. He was a knower of logic, the classical system of the system which describes the rules and procedures of systematic thought, by which analytic knowledge may be structured and interrelated. He was so swift at this, his Stanford Binet IQ, which is essentially a record of skill at analytic manipulation, was recorded at 170, a figure that occurs in only one person in 50,000. He was systematic, but to say he thought and acted like a machine would be to misunderstand the nature of his thought. It was not like pistons and wheels and gears all moving at once, massive and coordinated. The image of a laser beam comes to mind instead. A single pencil of light of such terrific energy and such extreme concentration, it can be shot at the moon, and its reflection seen back on Earth. Phaedrus did not try to use his brilliance for general illumination. He sought one specific distant target and aimed for it and hit it. And that was all. General illumination of that target he hit now seems to be left for me. In proportion to his intelligence, he was extremely isolated. There's no record of his having had close friends. He traveled alone, always. Even in the presence of others, he was completely alone. People sometimes felt this and felt rejected by it, and so did not like him. But their dislike was not important to him. His wife and family seemed to have suffered the most. His wife says those who tried to go beyond the barriers of his reserve found themselves facing a blank. My impression is that they were starved for some kind of affection, which he never gave. No one really knew him. That is evidently the way he wanted it, and that's the way it was. Perhaps his aloneness was the result of his intelligence. Perhaps it was the cause. But the two were always together, an uncanny, solitary intelligence. This still doesn't do it, though, because this and the image of a laser beam convey the idea that he was completely cold and unemotional, and that is not so. In his pursuit of what I have called the ghost of rationality, he was a fanatic hunter. One fragment becomes especially vivid now of a scene in the mountains where the sun was behind the mountain half an hour, and an early twilight had changed the trees and even the rocks to almost blackened shades of blue and gray and brown. Phaedrus had been there 3 days without food. His food had run out, but he was thinking deeply and seeing things, and was reluctant to leave. He was not far away from where he knew there was a road, and was in no hurry. In the dusk, coming down the trail, he saw movement, and then what seemed to be a dog approaching on the trail, a very large sheepdog, or an animal more like a husky, and he wondered what would bring a dog to this obscure place at this time of evening. He disliked dogs, but this animal moved in a way that forestalled these feelings. It seemed to be watching him, judging him. Phaedrus stared into the animal's eyes for a long time, and for a moment felt some kind of recognition. Then the dog disappeared. He realized much later it was a timber wolf, and the memory of this incident stayed with him a long time. I think it stayed with him because he had seen a kind of image of himself. A photograph can show a physical image in which time is static, and a mirror can show a physical image in which time is dynamic. But I think what he saw on the mountain was another kind of image altogether, which was not physical and did not exist in time at all. It was an image, nevertheless, and that is why he felt recognition. It comes to me vividly now because I saw it again last night as the visage of Phaedrus himself. Like that timber wolf on the mountain, he had a kind of animal courage. He went his own way with unconcern for consequences that sometimes stunned people, and stuns me now to hear about it. He did not often swerve to right or to left. I've discovered that. But this courage didn't arise from any idealistic idea of self-sacrifice, only from the intensity of his pursuit, and there was nothing noble about it. I think his pursuit of the ghost of rationality occurred because he wanted to wreak revenge on it, because he felt he himself was so shaped by it. He wanted to free himself from his own image. He wanted to destroy it because the ghost was what he was, and he wanted to be free from the bondage of his own identity. In a strange way, this freedom was achieved. This account of him must sound unworldly, but the most unworldly part of it is all yet to come. This is my own relationship to him. This has been forestalled and obscured until now, but nevertheless must be known. I first discovered him by inference from a strange series of events many years ago. One Friday I had gone to work and gotten quite a lot done before the weekend and was happy about that, and later that day drove to a party where, after talking to everybody too long and too loudly and drinking way too much, went into a back room to lie down for a while. When I awoke, I saw that I'd slept the whole night, because now it was daylight, and I thought, my God, I didn't even know the name of the hosts, and wondered what kind of embarrassment this was going to lead to. The room didn't look like the room I'd lain down in, but it had been dark when I came in, and I must have been blind drunk anyway. I got up and saw that my clothes were changed. These were not the clothes I had worn the night before. I walked out the door, but to my surprise, the doorway led not to rooms of a house, but into a long corridor. As I walked down the corridor, I got the impression that everyone was looking at me. 3 different times a stranger stopped me and asked how I felt. Thinking they were referring to my drunken condition, I replied that I didn't even have a hangover, which caused one of them to start to laugh, but then catch himself. At a room at the end of the corridor, I saw a table where there was activity of some sort going on. I sat down nearby, hoping to remain unnoticed until I got all this figured out. But a woman dressed in white came up to me and asked if I knew her name. I read the little name clip on her blouse. She didn't see that I was doing this, and seemed amazed, and walked off in a hurry. When she came back, there was a man with her, and he was looking right at me. He sat down next to me and asked me if I knew his name. I told him what it was, and was as surprised as they were that I knew it. "It's very early for this to be happening," he said. "This looks like a hospital," I said. They agreed. "How did I get here?" I asked, thinking about the drunken party. The man said nothing, and the woman looked down. Very little was explained. It took me more than a week to deduce from the evidence around me that everything before my waking up was a dream, and everything afterward was reality. There was no basis for distinguishing the two, other than the growing pile of new events that seemed to argue against the drunk experience. Little things appeared, like the locked door, the outside of which I could never remember seeing, and a slip of paper from the probate court telling me that some person was committed as insane. Did they mean me? It was explained to me finally that you have a new personality now. But this statement was no explanation at all. It puzzled me more than ever, since I had no awareness at all of any old personality. If they had said, "You are a new personality," it would have been much clearer. That would have fitted. They had made the mistake of thinking of a personality as some sort of possession, like a suit of clothes which a person wears. But apart from a personality, what is there? Some bones and flesh? A collection of legal statistics, perhaps, but surely no person. The bones and flesh and legal statistics are the garments worn by the personality, not the other way around. But who was the old personality whom they had known and presumed I was a continuation of? This was my first inkling of the existence of Phaedrus, many years ago. In the days and weeks and years that have followed, I've learned much more. He was dead, destroyed by order of the court, enforced by the transmission of high-voltage alternating current through the lobes of his brain. Approximately 800 mils of amperage at durations of 0.5 to 1.5 seconds had been applied on 28 consecutive occasions in a process known technologically as annihilation ECS. A whole personality had been liquidated without a trace in a technologically faultless act that has defined our relationship ever since. I have never met him, never will. And yet strange wisps of his memory suddenly match and fit this road and desert bluffs and white-hot sand all around us, and there is a bizarre concurrence, and then I know he has seen all of this. He was here. Otherwise, I would not know it. He had to be. And in these sudden coalescences of vision, and in recall of some strange fragment of thought whose origin I have no idea of, I'm not a clairvoyant, a spirit medium receiving messages from another world. That is how it is. I see things with my own eyes, and I see things with his eyes, too. He once owned them. These eyes. That is the terror of it. These gloved hands I now look at, steering the motorcycle down the road, were once his. And if you can understand the feeling that comes from that, then you can understand real fear. The fear that comes from knowing there is nowhere you can possibly run. We enter a low-rimmed canyon. Before long, a roadside stop I've been waiting for appears. A few benches, a little building, and some tiny green trees with hoses running to their bases. John, so help me God, is at the exit on the other side, ready to pull out onto the highway. I ignore this and pull up by the building. Chris jumps off, and we pull the machine back up on the stand. The heat rises from the engine as if it were on fire, throwing off waves that distort everything around it. Out of the corner of my eye, I see the other cycle come back. When they arrive, they are both glaring at me. Sylvia says, "We're just angry." I shrug my shoulders and walk to the drinking fountain. John says, "Where's all that stamina you were telling us about?" I look at him for a second and see he really is angry. "I was afraid you took that too seriously," I say. and then turn away. I drink the water, and it's alkaline, like soapy water. I drink it anyway. John goes into the building to soak his shirt with water. I check the oil level. The oil filter cap is so hot it burns my fingers right through the gloves. The engine hasn't lost much oil. The back tire tread is down a little more, but still serviceable. The chain is tight enough, but a little dry, so I oil it again to be safe. The critical bolts are all tight enough. John comes over, dripping with water, and says, "You go ahead this time. We'll stay behind." "I won't go fast," I say. "That's all right," he said. "We'll get there." So I go ahead, and we take it slowly. The road through the canyon doesn't straighten out into more of what we've been through, as I expected it would, but starts to wind upward. Surprise. Now the road meanders a little, now it cuts back away from the direction in which we should be going, then returns. Soon it rises a little, and then rises some more. We are moving in angular directions into narrow devil's gaps, then upward again, higher and a little higher each time. Some shrubs appear, then small trees. The road goes higher still into grass, and then fenced meadows. Overhead, a small cloud appears. Rain, perhaps? Perhaps. Meadows must have rain, and these now have flowers in them. Strange how all this has changed. Nothing to show it on the map, and the consciousness of memory has disappeared, too. Phaedrus must not have come this way. But there was no other road. Strange. It keeps rising upward. The sun angles toward the cloud, which now has grown downward, to touch the horizon above us, in which there are trees, pines, and a cold wind comes down with pine smells from the trees. The flowers in the meadow blow in the wind, and the cycle leans a little, and we are suddenly cool. I look at Chris, and he is smiling. I am smiling, too. Then the rain comes hard on the road with a gust of earth smell from the dust that has waited for too long, and the dust beside the road is pocked with the first raindrops. This is all so new. And we are so in need of it, a new rain. My clothes become wet, and goggles are spattered, and chills start and feel delicious. The cloud passes from beneath the sun, and the forest of pines and small meadows gleams again, sparkles where the sunlight catches small drops from the rain. We reach the top of the climb, dry again, but cool now, and stop, overlooking a huge valley and river below. "I think we have arrived," John says. Sylvia and Chris have walked into the meadow among the flowers under pines through which I can see the far side of the valley, away and below. "I'm a pioneer now, looking onto a promised land."